Hey, movie lovers, welcome back to another Anatomy of Movie. I hope you're ready to get upgraded because that's the movie we're going to talk about. Lee Whannell's latest directing venture. It is the science fiction body horror. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen, his second directing credit. He is directing this one. It's about a man who becomes a quadriplegic and then gets upgraded. And lots to talk about because that's good sci-fi. Allow me to introduce Dimitri Panos.
Hey, movie fans.
And Marissa Serafini.
Hello, everyone.
And I am Phil Svitek. Welcome to the show. We will be discussing Upgrade, the movie that recently just came out. We will be discussing it quite at length, both from a story perspective, from a behind-the-scenes perspective, and as well as the box office numbers and reception and all of that fun stuff. That said, we assume you've seen the movie, or at least if you don't care about spoilers, well, here's your warning for spoilers, because it's going to be spoiler-filled. Secondly, if you would like to follow along with the show, we do have a rundown that has all of our notes compiled for you, some of which we don't always get to, but we try to draw on as much as we can, and it just helps fill out the whole experience of the show, if you will. So without further ado, where we always start is with our overall thoughts, because it's an entryway into what we think of the movie. Marissa, why don't you kick us off?
Well, I saw the trailer for this movie probably 2 months ago, and I thought it looked really cool. I love the color palette. I love this camera work that was just shown in the trailer. I was like, this looks like a cool action movie with a sci-fi element, which I generally enjoyed. Watching the first 20 minutes, admittedly, it was hard for me to get through the first 20 minutes. It was felt very scripted, kind of cheesy, borderline acting. And, I mean, I watch Hallmark, so I know B-rated movies when I see one. But once we got to the actual action and stuff actually started happening, I was like, okay, cool. I can see why this film was being made. And it was a fun adventure. Admittedly, I liked the second and third act more than I did the first. But overall, it was a fun movie, and I was like, ha! I walked out of the movie theater, I was like, yeah, that was cool.
Awesome. Dimitri.
It's a B-sci-fi movie. Like, it makes no bones about it. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's actually the kind of movie that the industry needs. It needs to fill in, you know, where we have these mega-budgeted tent poles. It's good to have these lower-budgeted Blumhouse. We'll talk a little bit about that, I'm sure, later on in the show. It's Blumhouse Tilt. It's that brand's maiden voyage, so to speak, and I really liked it. It's what if Michael Crichton had written Death Wish? You would get Upgrade. It's got that sci-fi tech, the pros and cons of tech. Does it work? How good is it? Bad is it? And what happens and all the mayhem that it can cause. So, I had a really good time. Lee Whannell, you're right, it's his second time directing. And while there were many scenes and shots, I felt that they were like, wow, I hadn't seen a fight scene done this way before, which is cool for a small budgeted film. He's still in his first director kind of phase. I think he's progressing. He's moving along. And, you know, because there are some other shots that are like first-time director kind of shots. Like, ooh, look at me. That's an awesome shot. Where he doesn't quite need that. But I think that he's evolving as a director. And he's able to work with a micro budget, which isn't surprising. He and James Wan were cut from the saw cloth. So that was their baby. And talk about micro budget and making that work. And that's what he's doing here. And I think he made an enjoyable sci-fi B-movie thriller.
Yeah, as far as the budget, so we've been referencing, estimate about $3 to $5 million, which in this day and age, I think what ends up on screen is very low. Mm-hmm. I would have guessed much higher having seen what actually ends up happening. To me, the movie actually reminds me of a movie called Bound by the Wachowskis. It was their first movie before The Matrix, and it had it was a micro budget, and it just had a lot of fun elements that you would see later on in their work. And I think this isn't even though it's his second film, so it's not his first film, but I'm seeing the pieces come together for something, and I could see him directing something far larger if he so chooses to, or he can stay contained like this.
And he gets the opportunity. I mean, this reminded me of many movies. There was a movie called Hardware that had come out some years ago. Lawnmower Man, to an extent. But that's okay. When you're making a B sci-fi movie like this, that's okay. It's how you pull it off and what you're able to accomplish. There's brevity, short movie, 90 minutes, love that. The pacing for me, beginning to end, if it was over and I was like, this is perfect. I'm in, I'm out, I was entertained. The audience I saw it with was loving it. It's a fun movie.
Absolutely, and it has a really good twist that I want to spend a little bit of time on talking, but I don't want to talk about it just yet. So let's talk about the development of all of this, and then we'll get into the story overall. Because it's been in the works for a number of years at this point. As according to him, about 6 years, and what the inception of the idea was a quadriplegic man with a computer chip that would basically control his movements for him, the ones that he couldn't for the rest of his body. And at first it started off as the screenplay being called STEM, and he reworked it and reworked. And I think the biggest thing that sort of came out of this, I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but once the notion came about that he was going to direct this, and actually he cites it as it forced him to become a better writer, because now, you know, when you're writing and you're a script writer, you kind of your imagination gets the best of you, if you will.
Right.
And you kind of expand the universe every which way and don't really care about the budget. Then when the budget hits and you're like, ooh, how are we going to do this? You kind of constrict yourself, and yet you find creativity within those restrictions. And he's very proud that he was able to accomplish that. And now I think he's going to carry that forward, or so he says.
Right, and I like that. And we've covered a lot of different writers and all the rewrites as well. But I like that he had to realize that, yeah, a concept could be cool, but when you actually have to direct your own work, you have to make sure that the characters and storylines are fleshed out or make as much sense as you can so you yourself can actually direct your own work. And I like that, and it enforces a creativity on that end.
Yeah, well, and let's not forget, this is a Blumhouse picture. Oh, Blumhouse Tilt. Again, this is a subdivision of Blumhouse. They've made their bones about making small budgeted horror movies. And that forces isn't the right... It brings creativity to the table. And as I said, James Wan and Leigh Whannell, coming from, they were the originators of Saw. That's where they cut their teeth, or they, in order to figure out how do we make a low budgeted movie, and then they made Saw a success. But basically, Blumhouse, in a sense, is what, like Lionsgate when they released Saw, sort of they just take from that. Let's make micro budgeted films. They did The Conjuring, right? Annabelle movies. And they're just very smart. They're doing the upcoming Halloween. And it's, we don't need a ton of money. The Purge has done huge for them. Sorry that I keep on going back to titles. But we don't need a ton of money. We get creativity. And we get quality product that for the most part, general audiences enjoy. And yes, their bones are from horror movies. But they make them very well, and you can trust in them that if you're seeing something with Blumhouse or even now Blumhouse Tilt, you're going to be in for something that's going to be interesting and showcases the artistry of filmmaking, you know, because they really, I believe Blumhouse was also Get Out. Yeah. So Jordan Peele's directorial horror film, like his debut as a horror filmmaker.
An like, Oscar-winning writer.
Yeah, I mean, it nurtures that. It's a filmmaker nurturing thing. So with Leigh Whannell, I think he's always been used to these lower budgets. And you're right. His imagination, when he sits down with Blumhouse, then it becomes a, well, what do I need to take out? What do I need to slim down to fit this budget? And how can I do this creatively? It's a good thing because he turns out an entertaining film.
There are some aspects that I think he slimmed down a little too much, because I think one of my, I don't want to say bones to pick, but one of my issues with this film is that there were a lot of plot holes, a lot of plot holes that really bothered me. But the action and, you know, the storytelling and what we had kind of made up for it. But, you know, just the whole idea, if we're going to go into writing, the backstory of how come, like, where did this company even come from? Who is this mysterious blonde dude who's running it or who's creating this? Like, what's his purpose and who is he, you know, who's his boss? So, like, there just wasn't enough backstory for me to understand, like, why this is happening. I know it was happening, but I was like, what started it all? And some ideas that so the wife Asher, you know, like, she has a very well-to-do job. She works with technology, but everywhere they go, they're in, it seems like, the slums of the town. It was like things just didn't match up. Where there was a lot of technology here, no technology in this location, technology in this location. They some things just didn't connect, and I felt like there were just plot holes that weren't answered.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I wouldn't necessarily use the word plot holes. I think just questions, maybe. But when we talk about paring down things, like, what I did think was interesting, perhaps some of that was missing for you. But I do think that at least it did force him to take away some of the action and force in some of the stronger ideas or the notions that get brought up, especially with science fiction. I felt that. You know, and it is one of those tricky parts of especially a science fiction, that balance of answering questions and posing questions, because part of the fun, certainly for us, is talking about all those open-ended things. And yeah, you're right. You know, what's the universe like? What's this? And so I don't know.
I mean, I understood what was happening. Like, they gave us enough information to be like, okay, this person is this person, this is, they're doing X, Y, and Z, but some things just didn't match up. Like, and I don't mean to sound like I'm jumping all over the place, but when he goes to, when Logan Marshall Green, when his character goes to the first guy that he's tracking down, it's like in this boony area and rundown place, and like the guy that the criminal guy had a nice car, crappy house, but a nice working technology table. So there's just like, there was some only technology when it felt like it was convenient for the moment.
Yeah, my only counter to that is the world of Blade Runner. Blade Runner is a tech noir where there's a lot of slummy areas in LA, and the technology hasn't upgraded the homes, the apartments, the hotels, or whatnot. But I mean, more to the point, like, I felt that they set up who that doctor gentleman was, whose name I'm, please forgive me, the blonde haired guy.
The entrepreneur.
Yeah,
the Aaron.
Okay. Yeah, Aaron.
So Aaron, and then Gray, Logan Marshall Green, his wife worked for the competing company. Like, Aaron ran a multi-gazillion dollar high-tech company. She worked for the competing company. I mean, they had that dialogue where she was producing limbs, artificial limbs for people who went off to war, lost their limbs and things like that. He was working for the competing company. So to me, I got that all along, and he showcased this chip, this
STEM.
Millimeter, yes, yeah, STEM, which would, if put into market, could potentially put her business, her corporation, under. There wouldn't be the use of prosthetic limbs, artificial limbs. And there was this whole business espionage where people were stealing files. Like, they had people who were working for his wife's company who were the villains, the henchmen, let's say, and the upgrades that they were getting to their bodies. So there was that whole subculture, you know, I parsed out only through like the dialogue and the findings of things. You know, there were certain things. I mean, yeah, plot holes, yeah, But again, when I go into a B movie like this, I'm not expecting. I sort of kind of expect it going in. It's how are you going to entertain me? What are you going to do? And its ultimate core story, like, works. Like, there were certain situations that you wouldn't walk into. How do you, like, keep this a secret from your mom? And, like, yeah, there was stuff like that.
Let me see if this is the central idea for you guys. I've never seen we've seen a lot of movies, and when we talk about artificial intelligence, it's you brought up Blade Runner, right? More human than human. We talk a lot about emotions for robots and so forth. But I've never yet seen sort of an emotion of jealousy, right? So there's a core to a lot of these where we idealize artificial intelligence. It's like, no, they're human. You know, they're just like us. They deserve rights and so forth. And to me, this really stems from a place of jealousy on the part of STEM, because he's trying to eliminate everyone else but him. And he's trying to be the only one. Did you guys have a similar reading? And if so, what are the ramifications of that?
Yeah, kind of. If we're going to get into the twist at the end.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it.
STEM wants autonomy. I thought that was cool. I was like, oh, yeah, this is where, you know, eventually technology is going to bite everybody in the ass. I thought that was nice because we slowly saw the progression of STEM. Like, we had to get his permission and approval to do X, Y, and Z. And then when we take things away from STEM and reboot it, and I'm like, oh no, I had that thought. I was like, what's happening to STEM now? If you're like taking off the limits, taking off the boundaries of STEM. So we knew STEM was going to progress throughout the movie to the end of autonomy. And I thought that was actually very executed very well. Did I see it coming? No, not really. Honestly, no. Not to the point where STEM had such a high intelligence that he wanted the control of the mind in one area and control of the body in a whole other area. I thought that was pretty well done.
But my greater point is that it's for a selfish reason. You know, like when you look at sort of machines or any of this stuff, it's like there's a greater good and there's, you know, we're saving humanity by destroying them or something along those lines. And yet it's completely for selfish reasons.
Well, but here's, it's Terminator is what it is. STEM becomes self-aware. STEM is artificial intelligence. STEM manipulates the situation so that he's basically, why can't I think of the company in Terminator that comes alive?
Genesis?
No, it's not Genesis.
Skynet.
STEM is a form of Skynet. Skynet becomes aware and says, boop, I'm better than you. I'm wiping people out. STEM becomes aware. It's basically what it is. He manipulates the pieces of this puzzle so that STEM can get what it wants. And STEM itself has given itself an upgrade. Now it can take over a human form. And now it can pretty much go wherever it wants to go. Not too much unlike, if you think about it, Ex Machina in the ending of that movie, where we had an artificial intelligence escape this compound and is now free in the world to do whatever it wants to do. That's really a theme that's really not unlike what's happening in Upgrade.
My whole question was at the end of the film when he's walking out, and we realized that STEM has planned this all along, even before he got implanted into Gray. I was just wondering, like, how smart was STEM to begin with? Even because he was even manipulating his own creator before he was even implanted. So I was like, how high is this artificial intelligence already?
Well, quite high. I mean, one of the things I appreciated about the ending, right, when we talk about the twist, to me it's... Yes, it's the twist that STEM was the puppeteer of all of this from the get-go. But then we get that great moment where I was ready to throw something at the screen. I was like, it was all a dream! And then you're like, oh, wait, it's a dream for him now, but it wasn't.
It was a nice twist, and I was the same way going, oh, no, come on. See, that really is first-time filmmaking, breaking the, like, you know, faux pas, but it was cleverly done.
Yeah.
I sort of kind of like it. Okay, so we talk B-movie, right? So you had the Twilight Zone, and then there was this offshoot, an offshoot, but you had the Outer Limits, which wasn't exactly the Twilight Zone, really stayed in science fiction. This was an Outer Limits episode. I'm not meaning it any less, but it had that Outer Limits twist, you know, because that was a show, and that's what this sort of kind of is.
I felt like this was Black Mirror's cousin, honestly.
Which stems from the Twilight Zone.
Exactly. It goes along the same vein.
I feel like we should do a whole show of what we can compare this to. But as far as anything, though, on record, Terminator's the most similar one simply because Lee says that's the thing that gave him inspiration. I'm sure all these other things play a factor into it. That's just the one he explicitly states. Let's get into the meat of the story, though, of how we got there and all that. For me, Logan Marshall Green, he's known for a lot, but I actually liked him in a small show called Quarry.
Okay.
Mm. Didn't have a long run, only 8 episodes and one and done type of deal. But I think he works well for the story, especially kind of carrying it and having that duality of trying to be himself and yet being overtaken. I thought it worked really well. Let me ask you guys this in terms of a question. The tracking of his emotions and the control he has over his state of being, let's say. How did you guys feel that worked?
Are we talking about Gray?
Gray
the character.
Yeah, Gray the character. Thoughts?
I thought it was I thought his acting was actually pretty good. I've seen Logan Marshall Green in a little show called OC, which lasted a little longer than Quarry. So I liked his acting from the start, and I liked the progression of the emotions because you can tell that he was a loving husband. He got injured, literally gave up on life, where he tried to kill himself, and then the whole spectrum of going like, what the hell is happening to me, when STEM is first starting to control him, to the fighting where it's like, oh, I have no control. So like, you saw this broad range of different emotions: anger, depression, and then even at the end when he is trying to control STEM, because I like the fact that Gray still had his conscience. He still knew what was right and wrong this whole time. Yeah, he knew he couldn't control some of his emotions, but he never really wanted to kill anyone. He just wanted to stop them or maim them enough so he can like get the answers that he needed. He never wanted to kill people, even when he knows he has the ability to. But like he still was a good guy, despite everything his body was doing.
Yeah, I actually liked him in this movie. The first time I noticed him was in Prometheus, and he played one of the dumb scientists. And I was like, well, when you can't get Tom Hardy, you get this guy. You know, this is the guy. But then he was in this other low budget horror film called The Invitation, and he was really good in that movie, right? So I'm watching him in this movie going, yeah, this guy is good, particularly when he's given some decent story. He has a lot to do, and I believe that the movie's on his shoulders. Had you picked a lesser actor or somebody else, may not have worked so well, but he handled himself from both the emotional side and the action side, and he did very well. He was charismatic enough where he draws your attention on screen. I believed in his relationship with his wife. I also believed in his sorrow. And as to what's happening to him, and then the loss of control. Again, to make a quick comparison, we're going to see something later on this summer that trailers have already been playing for, but Venom. So if you've watched the Venom trailer, there are scenes where Tom Hardy is doing things with Venom going, I don't know what's going on here. Symbiotic relationship with something. This is technology. I think that he got it right. And he does a really good job, particularly considering how everything was staged and choreographed with camera movements. He's believable in the action scenes. And
stay down, man. Just stay down.
Just yeah.
I love that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is kind of more behind the scenes, but it does kind of talk about the relationship between Stem and him. The actor Simon Madden, who voiced Stem, he actually was on set voicing it in real time, and that was a very deliberate notion. In some sense, the way I look at it, a costly notion, you know, because you can get a guy in to the ADR booth for like 1 to 2 days versus how many days on set just talking to the guy. But as far as the result, it's evident on screen that he is really reacting to, and they are reacting to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciated that as far as the technique.
So in a little behind the scenes, too, according to Leigh Whannell, too, the hiring or casting Logan Marshall Green, he says, was not an audition process. They were having a tough time. And talk about, I don't mean any disrespect to Logan Marshall Green, but talk about, like, they were thinking sky high at first, right? People that they were thinking about, Jake Gyllenhaal, Christian Bale, these are big movie stars, which you would understand because they're a marquee name. They can get people in. But then when you talk about budget, that's a different story. They might not want to take that pay cut, right? I think they would have done really well, but you understand. So even when Al mentions the invitation, and apparently he came to his house. He had some notes. You roll your eyes when you hear that. Oh, God, here come the notes, Leigh Whannell says. And his were really great. He actually thought about the script and the story. And there was nothing flippant about the way he talked about sharing his ideas. And Leigh Whannell was like, done. You're part of this collaborative process. And you're doing it in a way that means you really took the time and care to read my script. I like that.
Well, it also shows that he knows the character, right? If you're going to embody someone like that, you have to be pretty intimate as far as knowing the history of it, right? That fills out the plot holes.
he knew his character. Yes.
Indeed.
And again, it's a sci-fi trope, too, when you have... We're in a world of technology. Cars can drive themselves. And he's an actual... old school car mechanic. He puts these cars, he rebuilds old school engine cars with catalytic converters and mufflers and spark plugs. So he's the old school guy who sort of shrugs technology off, and his wife is the person who works in tech. So that's one of those, aversion to tech, but yet it's tech that can
save
him. I like
the gender
him.
Flip on that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I love how women are getting better storylines in Hollywood, but usually you see the guys in the technology, not the women. So I like how they gave her a big role within the technological world.
Do we find it a case of fridging in this movie, where she dies for the purposes of his motivation?
Yeah.
We've talked about fridging in the past, but for those of you unaware, it's where in order for the male protagonist to have a motive to move forward, usually the wife gets killed off or
but it's raped. A demeaning way in which the woman is treated. I didn't think she was demeaned by her murder, so to speak, in a sense. Like, she wasn't put in a refrigerator, you know?
I mean, not literally, but...
No, but, you know, the death came...
But he's the reason why he's going and investing everything and keeps going to each location and each guy and interrogating everybody.
It's Death Wish. I mean, that's the story of Death Wish. It's coming, seeking revenge of the people who hurt you and your family, who took them away from you. And it's going to hunt those bad guys down and do them some harm. So something had to motivate, if she lived... Then it becomes a completely different story. She dies, and again, you want to talk a little bit of a plot hole. It sort of kind of amazed me that it took them so long to figure out that guy didn't have a gun. It took 3 years? Was it?
3 months. 3 months.
3 months. And that detective, like, she wasn't a very good detective. Let's just say that. And it's like, wow, Stem.
I completely agree.
Yeah, she wasn't a great detective. Awful. And it took her that long. And, like, she still didn't realize that they didn't have a gun. it was weird because when the wife gets shot, I was like, where'd that come from? Mm-hmm. I haven't seen the bullet gun on her in a while. But the emotional heft, and again, she dies early on in the movie, right? So you have to sort of kind of be a little bit sappy with their relationship to sort of draw you in, so that when, if you want any emotional impact, it's from the Paul Verhoeven school of I'm going to kill a main character off in the very beginning. You really don't know the person. I'm talking RoboCop. I got to make the death extremely violent so that you can care for the person you really don't know. And here you just make it sort of sappy. You know that they're in love with one another, so that when it comes, there is an emotional heft for the audience in one way, shape, or form.
But also, like RoboCop, he personally was affected too. Like, his body wasn't capable of the regular human motion anymore. Just like Gray in this movie, like, he was paralyzed. So, yeah, he lost his wife, but also he lost his ability to just live out a normal human life as well. And so I think, yeah, it definitely became just a personal motivation to get the story moving.
Yeah, absolutely. But it was at that point, too, it was like, well, they killed her. Why didn't they kill him? They left him a quadriplegic.
That's the question.
Why? And as soon as that doctor showed up at the hospital, I was like, he did this. He's orchestrated this. Mm-hmm. Because there was no reason to keep him alive after a mugging. So, and he witnessed his wife getting killed. So, there had to have been a reason. They just didn't realize that shooting the wife, which she wasn't actually supposed to get killed.
Huge collateral damage.
That ends up being the instigation. That's the inspiration for our Gray to go out. And when he's able to walk again, he wants to do a better job than the detective. Because she really was not a good detective.
Well, the problem is during that whole the shooting, you know, that shootout part, like, the guy took off his mask. It was like, with all the technology you have around you, with all the drones in the air, I'd imagine you have facial recognition. And the fact that it's been 3 months and you still don't know who these guys are, is with all the technology presented literally in front of your faces in your office, you have all these screens and you can't get one answer. So it really bothered me when technology worked when it needed to for the storyline, and then it didn't work when it didn't need to.
Yeah, I just took her as, she was just not good at her job. She just really wasn't.
She tried. I'm like, and I'll give her
that.
And
she was looking at the wrong, you know, she was great at finding out Gray who was doing stuff, right? But no, you should be finding out who the bad guys are, you know, and why Gray is doing this.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with you guys.
Technology, like, worked at only when it was convenient for them.
Let me ask you this, in that case, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's interesting that Gray starts off so anti-technology overall. Mm-hmm. And the crux of the movie is that, well, he in order to serve this greater thing, he has to accept technology, right? Yes. And obviously it kind of, from my perspective, bites him in the ass. Whether or not you disagree, you can tell me in a moment. But so I just find it interesting, because I think it goes beyond just technology. There's this notion that, like, if you're so against something, but then when you can look at it as a selfish reason that something comes along and can help you, then you know what? All bets are off because it serves your greater good. Maybe not the greater good of things in general.
Right, and I think the only reason why he actually said yes to the operation was the exact line that was actually fed from STEM to Aaron, what would your wife do? And when you bring it back into the wife would be accepting of the technology and say, do the operation. So that's the only reason why, because we had the wife's motivation.
Yeah, it was brought to an emotional level. And again, it's one of those things that from a technology standpoint, why wouldn't you try? I mean, you know, you're so desperate. But it was very interesting that once it was implanted and once he was able to walk and jog and run again on a treadmill, very $6 million man-ish, by the way, is when they had him running on the treadmill. That was something else that I couldn't help but think of. He he was like, wow, this is actually sort of kind of cool. So much so that when he was told he had to keep it a secret and that he couldn't walk everywhere, he was sort of upset. Like, rightfully so.
Yeah, like, red flag. It's like, I can't show this.
What do you mean? I can't walk to the store and buy my own groceries? I can't drive a car? Well, what the hell, man? Why'd you do this to me if I can't benefit from what's going on? So I think he accepted. He could walk again, use his arms. He was able to find things out. But I think he accepted it so much that when he was told that he couldn't use it, it's like, well, what the hell did you do to me this? What did you do this to me for? I like that. You know, it was only towards the end when he started realizing I'm being taken over. And that's not a good thing. So all my rights about technology were right. Damn, I'm a robot. You know, I'm STEM. Well, nothing I can do.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's kind of...
He did get kicked in the ass. It bit him in the ass, as you said.
Yeah, Aaron tried shutting him down remotely. It's like, the red flags would be confidentiality NDA or whatever. NDA... It's like, don't tell anyone. Yeah, that should be a red flag. He should have asked those questions before he did the operation.
But I guess the greater question is, forget like just the story of this, like as far as what it represents as a larger whole to society, I think NDAs, no NDAs, we just kind of, we accept things on a surface level because, oh, this will be great. It'll be fantastic. Yeah. Oh, I didn't think about that.
Yeah, and it goes to, I'm going to paraphrase that great Blade Runner quote. I'll just say technology is either a benefit or a hazard. If it's a benefit, it's not my problem. Like, you know, and technology can be a tool until Skynet becomes self-aware and decides to blow up the human race. And that's what we're sort of kind of seeing here, the upgrade of technology.
The upgrade, indeed. What a great title, huh?
It was a good title for this. Yeah, I think it's multiple a better title than STEM.
It's multiple meanings.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, let's shift gears and talk about the action choreography, because it is vastly different than a lot of things that I've seen. Although I can't say I haven't seen something similar, and what I can reference to is. Remember the bathroom fight scene in The World's End? Mm-hmm. For those of you that remember, it's the notion that you're kind of seeing the action in a very wide shot and things are spinning and twisting because the camera is held stationary and so you're kind of strapped onto something and pretty much quite literally that's how they pulled it off.
Right.
As they explain, you actually take an iPhone and strap it under the actor's clothes and the camera lens locks onto the phone. So whenever the phone moves, it sits in a housing like motion control. And the Steadicam operator would hold this camera housing and the camera would sit in a swivel and whenever Logan moved, it would go.
Right.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, he sort of likened it to, he said the Matrix invented like bullet time. That was the very first time where we saw the multiple camera and camera go around to see all the action. He says, I gotta come up with a cool name of what I did. He goes, the lockdown camera, maybe? So I still think he needs a little work on that, but we're getting there.
I thought the fighting was awesome.
The fight scenes were really
especially
good.
The moments where you just see the body get up from the floor straight up. It's like, yeah, we see that move in Matrix all the time, but the way the camera moved with the actor, that was cool. And like they showed that in the trailer. That's why I was like, this movie looks awesome. Because just the cinematography and how it captured when he was walking like straight towards the camera, the background is still, it's kind of in motion, but it's still static at the same time. And you're like, how the hell did they pull that off? Motion control's been around for years. So I like how they married the two to make it look static, but also there's motion to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the fight scenes, and according to the audience that I saw it with at my local theater, were something that we really haven't seen before. And up to this point, let's think about it, right? We've seen Marvel movies. We've seen Star Wars movies. And it's this little micro-budgeted B-movie that is showing us this summer something that we really haven't seen before. And it looks cool. When he gets up and he's, like, moving his arm. Like, and that's the other thing, too, that I'm going to give Logan Marshall Green credit for. His choreography and the way that he moved was very precise, like you would figure STEM would be. But it showed us stuff in a way that we haven't seen before. And I think from its low budget, it was that forced creativity. Had he had, I don't know, $25 million to work with, we may not have gotten this. It may have looked better. It may have looked different.
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm.
Not necessarily better, though.
A couple of – it's the cinematography that goes into it. I think the sound effects themselves, but also there's an added layer of humor to it, to the choreography that, much like the cinematography, makes it spins on its head,
right?
And it's just fun to watch in that way because it doesn't take itself too seriously. As you mentioned, Marissa, like, just stay down.
Yeah, stay down.
And yet you're watching this very serious fight scene, the culmination of which is one of the most brutal things I've ever seen, with a full knife to the through the I'm not even going to describe it.
Yes, but let's talk about this for
so
one
painful.
Second, right? We saw the aftermath. Sound effects, and it was locked on Logan Marshall Green. It was locked on Gray, and all we heard was and screaming, and we didn't actually see the rapid knife cuts. So again, when you're working low budget, this is a great way that you can do that.
Use the imagination.
Have the audience with sound effects, a good actor, you could have the audience imagine anything. What you may have visualized and what Marissa visualized and I visualized, they could have been on different levels of gruesome. And then we see what happens.
Trust me, it was gruesome.
Yeah, it was gruesome.
I think the first guy, when he went to the house and the whole knife to the mouth head, that was painful to look at.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
And then it gets culminated by the joke of like, hey, take out the fingerprints. Oh, how am I supposed to know? I know.
I have a record.
And it's just like, okay, it was a funny beat to end on for something that ended so gruesome.
Yeah, yeah. I felt like all the action moments had a beat of levity where, stay down and all that. Or like, ninja, I am not a ninja. Or when he's even rebooting STEM, he's like, welcome back, there's always like that one beat, be like, okay, here's some humor, and now we're going to get some death.
Right.
Absolutely. What's interesting, I couldn't find, I'd be very curious, but when we talk about the cinematography itself, Stefan Duccio, I apologize for the butchering of the name, he's the cinematographer, but he says that the fight scenes were a technique he used in a music video. So, in a sense, he kind of recycled his own bit. I'm unable to find the name of the music video itself, though, so I apologize for that. If you guys want to leave a comment for everyone's benefit to let them know what the music video is, by all means do that. Secondly, as far as the color and so forth, it's been compared to Nicholas Winding Refn. As far as the
Drive.
Yeah.
Drive,
yeah, I can see
yeah.
that for sure.
I love
absolutely.
the red and blue.
I mean, there were hints for me anyways, too, of Blade Runner to an extent. The only thing, okay, so going to your technology analogy, like, so there's all this technology around, right?
Mm-hmm.
Cars, even they even took time to make the cars look different, even helicopters, most everything looked different except for the clothes. There was nothing like, the clothes just looked like they were bought today. Yeah. Clothes fashion has not changed in whatever, I forget how many years in the future this movie took place.
I don't think they said.
Yeah, they didn't. And that's why I had a hard time just establishing where we were. And it's like, okay, I imagine we're sometime in the future, but not the too far distant future. Because they still had regular cars on the highway. We saw regular cars getting crashed. But every time we had the automatic car, the self-driving car, it looked like a more souped-up Prius.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and again, I like the inside is like a computer screen, and then its opacity can change, mm-hmm. and it becomes a window. The whole thing about hacking a car is.
But that's not very new.
Interesting. No, I mean, we saw it in the Fast and the Furious.
Yeah,
we saw.
There's an episode of Criminal Minds that
cars were
hacked.
It's interesting. I liked how the cars looked, but and again, what I appreciated is that it was futuristic, but not so far futuristic. There was stuff that was still we could root into what we're seeing daily, except again for the clothing. It just looked like, and I'm not a fashion guy, but it's one thing that stuck out to me is like, that hasn't changed at all in whatever world this is.
At least Blade Runner looked like it was in the future.
I mean, I think there is a side to it when you talk about like kind of the first time directing bug and whatnot. As far as the production design side of it, I will side a little bit more with Marissa. Simply like when we first meet Aaron, like we go into this thing and it's just like, it's there just to be cool. And it's cool.
It is, but
it's a concrete house.
Underground.
But
again, I'm going to go back to the low budget thing of this. Like, what are they actually doing? They found a location which they can walk down and disappear and look as if they're walking down. I don't know if that stone gateway exists. It looks as if it did. But I found that was a cool way to approach something where we don't have to show the exterior of this house. We don't really have to do much. We can have them here and then they walk down. And who knows if they were even walking steps. They could do the fake, I'm getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And then we show them on a set that we built.
I mean, again, it's quite eccentric. And obviously, Aaron is an eccentric person. But sometimes it's eccentric for the sake of eccentricity.
But was he really eccentric? Because my problem is Aaron, like, we know nothing about him other than the fact that he knows how to actually physically create STEM, but he ended up being a bitch. Like, he ended up being a puppet and being a slave to the STEM. So, and like, he was mysterious to the point I was like, is he the villain? Should we trust him in that sense? But then when, you know, with the whole reveal, he's like, I was just following commands of STEM. He ended up being nobody.
Well, I don't think he was nobody. I mean, I honestly do believe that he was a character. I mean, he built a multi-million-dollar tech corp. He was high into technology. And he created STEM. He was trying to get it tested. He needed to find a way in which to get this out into the marketplace. In fact, when the wife first meets him, and without knowing who he is by looks, but once she realizes who he is, she goes, oh my God, you're Aaron. You're that Aaron? He's like, yeah, she knew of who he was just from he's almost like the Bill Gates, so to speak. And he's big in the tech company. And again, I'll reference Ex Machina, the Isaac Olmos, Oscar Isaacs, I should say. The Oscar Isaacs character, he's somewhat of a mystery too, yet he's created a ton of technology, you know, for the world and is noted, but he's very isolated.
Yeah, it's like, that's what happens when you isolate yourself.
Yeah, that's what happens. Yeah, you do. You sort of kind of lose your mind. When you have... That character even admitted, I don't have much social grace.
No, but like, when we first see Aaron, he's playing with a cloud, a dark cloud, which literally establishes his character as a very moody guy, or at least melancholy on some level. So I would just, there were so many things about Aaron that I had questions for that were never answered. So again, that adds to my whole quote-unquote plot hole problem.
Yeah, I didn't need anything answered. He was just a wicked smart guy who's a little bit...
Well, his head's in the clouds instead of his ass.
Exactly.
Yeah, he's just trying to... And I actually did feel that he was trying to create something that could have been for the benefit of humanity rather than a detriment. He didn't want STEM to take over, so to speak. And even at that point, Lee Whannell talks of Eron saying Stem was his child. And it's like, even had he hacked in and shut Stem down before Gray went to the hacker, he would have taken Stem back to the lab and he would have turned him back on again. So it was just a question of his motivation and what he was trying to do. And I felt that it was it. Like, I didn't need backstory of where Eron came from. He was just a wicked smart guy who built super technology. And he was awkward around people.
To that notion of a child.
Socially inept.
I like that. Yes.
Lee Whannell did compare this movie as very much like a child. You know, you go into it with a certain idea, but then it takes its own form. And it grows as the project continues on, and it goes the direction that it wants to go, not necessarily that you had in mind for it. But he cites that in the best of ways, rather than like, it didn't turn out the way I wanted. So I think that's quite an interesting thing. The other thing I want to talk about, the sound design and the music, in particular, the voice of using narration as credits. As part of the opening logo, I've never heard it before, where Blumhouse presents.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We've heard narration, but never Blumhouse presents.
We've never had it. We've never had title cards necessarily narrated to us. And it stopped right about the time that the title would come up.
Yeah.
And you're right, and there are a lot of title cards. Okay. I saw something and heard something that I'd never seen and or heard in a movie before. It's like, wow, they're narrating this in a computer voice. I thought it was sort of cool.
I thought it was cool, and it was just a good kind of establishment / foreshadowing of what we were going to see. Absolutely. In the film, knowing that Stem was playing with the sound waves in Gray's head. I was like, the whole audio wavelengths actually did play a big part in this movie.
Yeah,
that they did. That was such an interesting way to open up a movie, for sure. Speaking of opening up, let's talk about the music, right? What did you guys... The interesting part for me was that it was serious at times it needed to be, but then overall, it had, especially in the fight choreography, it had this sort of... I don't want to say upbeat or jovial, but something wasn't as serious, let's say.
Right.
Hmm.
As was on the surface. What did you guys think of it?
It was tech. It was okay.
Yeah, very tech.
I found it to be tech heavy. Mm-hmm. It was, for the purposes of this movie, I didn't find that it overpowered. I don't think there was a scene in which it dominated what was taking place. I thought it was a good bed. Not a soundtrack that I would necessarily upload, download, or purchase so that I can listen to it many times over again. But I think for the purposes of this movie, I think what they set out to do, they accomplished.
Yep. And Jed Palmer, by the way, is the one who has done it. Marissa, what were your thoughts?
I like the music, especially during the fighting choreography. Tech, it sounded like something you can kind of hear in a club. But also it could be like a nice bed underneath for the storyline, and felt like it kind of came like, or it was more inspired by like a Black Mirror. I could hear this music in a Black Mirror episode.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it. It felt technology futuristic, but yet still subtle in orchestra.
Right.
Well, speaking of all of this, the culmination of all this work, It got him an audience award at South by Southwest back in March. So kudos to them, and I could see why, and overall, I'm glad we're talking about it, because it is a really, really small movie as far as certainly its budget. But then we also talk about some of the movies we talk about, its marketing budget is bigger than most movies I ever dream of making. And so, as Whannell said, not a lot of budget behind it for promotion, so he's very happy about that it is getting out there in the ways that it is getting.
Yeah, this is an interesting, this is an upgrade in a sense, or at least a hybrid. So we have Blumhouse Tilt. Okay. So this, an offshoot of Blumhouse. Blumhouse falls under the Universal Pictures umbrella currently, although The Conjuring, I know, are Warner Brothers, but for the most part, they're making movies now for Universal. But they incorporated, Blumhouse Tilt incorporated an indie company called Neon. We know Neon through iTanya. That's where they've made their bones from, okay? And the way that it sort of kind of is working out is that Neon is handling or handled the marketing for this movie, where Universal took the marketing, a lot of the in-theater marketing materials, right? And Universal, with their clout, was able to get posters or trailers up on screen, and they used the clout of the Universal Distribution Department to get the movie in 1,500 locations. Personally, I think there is a conflict there, and I'm not saying that Universal, like, go one way or the other. And if you're going to be indie and you're going to have this little offshoot, I think Neon has proved that they can, A, open a picture, B, that they can have a picture that gets good reviews. And this has gotten good reviews, that they can keep a picture in theaters. Now, Blumhouse, though, at the same time, they don't want to cannibalize themselves, because in July, you've got, you're going to have The Purge coming out. So, and then later on in October, you'll have Halloween. Not that this movie upgrade is going to be around until October, but theaters probably, there's some deal in place where theaters have to play upgrade on for so many, you know, amount of weeks. But I think in a sense, it almost hurt them, because trying to get, they're almost, they're doing this to each other. They're fighting each other, because Universal is not going to want to take a Purge trailer off screen to put up upgrade. And remember, it's Blumhouse, right? So it's all falling under this. They don't want to cannibalize what they have going on screen. So it's tough. And I'm not sure that the release date necessarily helped either company out, because you are coming sort of kind of close to the Purge date, okay? Mm-hmm. And trailer placement, there wasn't a ton. You saw it online a lot, and it got a lot of buzz. Going into a theater, you had to take secondary pictures. You weren't getting on the opening weekend of big movies. You would see the Purge trailer instead. Does any of this make sense?
Like, a little, yeah.
Okay. So you had that going into play, and I think from a marketing standpoint, it's too bad. I think it sort of hurt this movie, because you did get great word of mouth. You got really good reviews. But if Universal, they have to do this job, but they got The Purge coming out, and they want that to be big for 4th of July, which movie are they paying attention to a little bit more?
Purge. So, and Purge has a franchise behind it already. Correct. So.
And it's just done so good for everyone.
Yeah.
I'm referencing the tagline.
Yeah.
Remember so, how...
Yeah, and that's why I think Upgrade, had it been released maybe in February, or maybe we're not so close to a Blumhouse picture, it would have been given its time to breathe, and those reviews would have really saturated the marketplace, and we'd have seen some more trailer placement. You know, I think it is a movie that deserved a little bit more than what was given to it. And it was also a first time, this Blumhouse Tilt. I think it was an experiment for them, too, to see what they would be able to accomplish by working with Neon Pictures and things. Ultimately, I don't think it was a complete failure. I wish that it had been a little more of a success. That's all.
Fair enough. Well, as far as all that, you know, he did say, Winnell, that if it did well in the box office, although at the moment, given projections and what's happening, he doesn't feel like it's going to warrant a sequel. Which is, here's the thing. I didn't need a sequel necessarily to begin with, so I'm not too upset, but I do want him to be able to create more movies.
Mm-hmm.
So make another movie rather than a sequel, is right. my opinion.
Yeah.
So I still want it to do well. 86% on Rotten Tomatoes last time I checked.
Pretty high.
Pretty high.
Considering the genre of movie we're talking about. Yeah, it's pretty high. It's higher than Solo on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, that's incredible. As they cite it, it's a highbrow, lowbrow gem from Blumhouse, and it's exactly sort of sick, satisfying genre flick you want smuggled in among the big ticket summer blockbusters right now.
Yeah, and I said that at the top too.
I agree with that.
These are the movies that are important to our business. We can't have movies of this budget go away because they help elevate our box office. Not only do they help elevate, they give us a good variety of things to view. They give us a different viewpoint. They'll give us a different view period. This isn't an Avengers movie. This isn't a Solo movie or any other kind of a tentpole. This is low budget. We're going to see something different that we go in. Maybe not the most original story in the world, but we're still going to see something different that's visceral and exciting and thrilling. And we'll come out going, that's good. It helps propel our box office and push it up a little bit more. A little. Not a lot. People aren't going to get overly rich from this movie, but it's still good for the business that these movies are allowed that they can remain in the marketplace.
But you can tell this was a movie that was strictly creative, passion-fueled. It's not, like you said, it's not a tentpole, but it is one of those films that you just want to put it out there because it's a fun film to watch. It allows people to still have fun movies to watch and give them a different option other than movies that only are created just for money. This was created because of creativity, because of a story, because people just wanted to make a film and they put it out there. So good for them.
Yeah, when I was waiting in a concession line, and somebody said, "What's this upgrade movie?" And I turned around and I said, "You should go see it if you haven't. You seem like you like this genre. Go see it. It's a good movie." It's fun. It's, I don't think people would be disappointed. We're not disappointed.
No.
Simon, I talked with him.
From Meet the Movie Press.
Yeah, Simon from Meet the Movie Press, which I was just on earlier today. But a lot of people I've spoken to who've seen the movie went out and said, you know what, I had a good time.
Yeah. Well, the other benefit of it, of these smaller movies, is that in order to get to the bigger movies, you got to start somewhere and you kind of build your skill set, your toolbox, and you get to that level where you can direct an Avengers movie or Star Wars movie.
Right.
So yeah, it's all par for the course, and I'm glad we're talking about it. I'm glad we did it. And if you've made it this far and you haven't seen the movie, go see the movie. Go see the movie.
Absolutely. And like for Lee Winnell too, it's good for him. Even. Eventually, he'll get to direct a bigger budgeted film. But if he stays within this micro-budget world, that's all good. Remember, it took James Wan a few movies before they gave him a Fast and Furious movie. And then he went back to doing a Conjuring movie. And now he's doing Aquaman. So once Lee gets more under his belt, and he has full support, by the way, from James Wan, he'll get there. I mean, he too is upgrading as a director.
So, that he is.
Yeah,
he's doing pretty well. Marissa, final thoughts.
Fun film. I think there's definitely a rewatchability factor for this. It's definitely B-rated, but it's good action. I think the action and just the concept really makes up for it. And I would recommend this to most people.
Yeah, I would recommend it to anybody who likes this type of film. I mean, it is violent. So it is a genre. It's heavy genre, sci-fi thriller. It's a B-movie. But it works. Regarding a sequel, look, if this is a one-off as a self-contained movie, it's fine. Yeah, it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it's got the twist ending. Fine. If they were to make a sequel, if it were to come to that, I'd more than likely go. I want to see what happens to Gray.
Maybe he's upgraded already. Who knows? Well, you guys have been listening to us talk for a long time. But here's your opportunity. You get to comment and let us know what you thought of the movie. Do you guys disagree? Do you guys agree? What do you guys think of the nature of humanity, of technology? How far is too far? Let us all know all those thoughts and opinions. What did you think of the action? All that fun stuff. What's your favorite Lee Wan L movie, including the stuff he's written, not just the twos that he's directed? Let us know. We truly do appreciate it. We read them. In the meantime, you can also interact with us on a more intimate level via social media at Serafini TV for Marissa.
That's right.
At DMovies1701.
Yes, I appreciate your support.
And I'm at Phil Svitek, or just go to philsvitek.com. Speaking of the summer months, we've got a whole heck of a lot of movies. We've been doing about two a week, one longer, one a little bit shorter. We're going to do a couple of bonus ones. We're going to be doing about three a week. We're going to try to give you everything we can. And some of you guys will say, but what about this movie? We're trying. There's a lot of movies out there.
There are.
So, but hey, that's a high class problem, isn't it?
First world problems. High class quadrant. Yes.
So, it's a good problem.
We're highfalutin, right?
Yes, indeed. Speaking of which, just to give you a little overview, we will be doing RBG a little bit later today, so you can look out for that. Next week, what do we got? We got Ocean's 8 and Hereditary. Yes. And down the line, I'm just trying to think down the line, we've got Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom.
Mission Impossible, Fallout.
I can't even think that far ahead. I'm just thinking the next 2 to 3 weeks.
We also have Tag.
Tag. Can't wait.
Fun movie, I'm sure.
Can't wait.
I did see Adrift. We will try to do that a little bit later. I thought it was a good movie. Shailene Woodley really showed her acting chops in that, and kudos to her. Good movie if you haven't seen it. We'll try to talk about that one a little bit later. We're going to try to do some documentaries here and there. Won't You Be My Neighbor? The Mr. Rogers one. We're going to try to push just a lot of cramming in there. Lots to look forward to. Speaking of which, as much as there's to look forward to, there's a lot of stuff in the past. So if you're just catching up on some of the movies that you haven't seen in its first run, by all means, revisit our archives on iTunes. It only has the most recent 300. I know, go figure. If you want the full list of over 400 movies we've covered, go to popcorntalk.com, and it has all the audio and the video there, so for your convenience. Again, Dimitri, Marissa, and me are here to sign off. Until next time.
Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of its owners or principals.